Alrighty, we are almost done with the story of Gideon, and only a few review questions this morning, so the competition is going to be fierce. We're almost done with Gideon. We've seen some great lessons from Gideon, and last time we were together, 2 weeks ago, we saw a third principle of faith. Can anybody give me, and I'll throw one chocolate per principles to spread this out a little bit. Can anybody give me one of the principles of faith that we've looked at so far? There's three of them. Nope. Brad. No, that goes under the principle. What was God doing to Gideon there? As he cut down his army.
Well, he's trying to give him trust and increase his faith.
There we go. He was testing our faith. So God tests our faith. That was the first principle we looked at. What was the second or the third principle? You can go out of order. He encourages our faith. Do you remember how he encouraged Gideon? Absolutely. Yep. So he God tests our faith. He encourages our faith. And then thirdly, what did we look at the last? Good memory. That was 3 weeks ago.
What chapter are we in?
We are in chapter 8 this morning. We've been in chapter 7. What was the last principle?
Didn't he give us an opportunity?
What did that opportunity fall under the principle of? I'm going to throw you a chocolate because
I don't.
He honors our faith. He tests our faith, he encourages our faith, and he honors our faith. And he did that to Gideon by giving him wisdom in the army, or in the battle, courage, and then like Tom said, he gave him an opportunity. And as we looked at that third principle last week, and Tom just mentioned it, that God honored Gideon's faith in three ways. He gave him wisdom, specifically wisdom in the battle. Gideon had developed a very unique battle plan. Who can describe that battle plan? Amanda.
He would divide them up into three different groups. Each of them would have torches hidden in jars and stuff like that. And then when they each went in different parts of the camp, they broke the jars and yelled for Gideon.
And what was the significance with the jars and the torches? And absolutely. Yep, it was. It was a very, very simple plan, but a plan that demonstrated just how God's ways are so far beyond our ways. And then the second way that God honored Gideon's faith was that he gave him courage in battle. Gideon was responsible for leading the smaller company of 300 men against 135,000 men. And like Amanda said, they broke into three different groups, so it was probably even more of a daunting task. But then the Lord took over from there. What happened next? What did God do?
He confused them. They pretty much turned against each other.
Yep. We've seen it before with Barak and Deborah, that God intervened and confused the army so that they started fighting against each other. So did God confuse or did Gideon cause the confusion in the Midianite soldiers? No, it was God that did it. But that's how God works in our lives. He calls us to be available and have the faith in him to take each step in, and he does the rest. What was the last way, Tom, that God honored Gideon's faith? He gave him an opportunity. An opportunity to do what? Does anybody remember? I said it just 2 minutes ago. Maybe I didn't say it. He gave Gideon an opportunity to enlarge his army, to strengthen his army. Gideon called for more help. He received that help as well as a victory. God honored his faith by giving him wisdom, courage, and an opportunity not only to strengthen himself in the Lord, but really the nation as a whole, to strengthen the nation in the Lord. All right, that's it for review. We've got to cruise through. I've only got a few weeks left to cover the rest of the judges. But like I said, we're almost done with Gideon's story. We've seen him come quite a long way since we found him in the wine press. He started off slow to fully trust the Lord, and we called him a coward. But then as he grew in the Lord and he became that conqueror that the Lord had called him to be. But unfortunately, from the rest of Gideon's story, that's not how we leave him. We don't leave him as a national hero, as that conqueror. So let me ask a question. When it comes to our victories in the Christian life, what do we know is very possible to follow up our victories?
Pride.
I asked what when it comes to our victories in the Christian walk, what do we know is very possible to follow a victory? And Roberta said pride.
Difficulty.
Sometimes the most vulnerable that we can be to Satan and his attacks is right after a great spiritual victory. We can win the war, but sometimes we can lose the victory. There was an article that was published in Pulse magazine that was basically making the readers aware of the dangers in traveling to foreign countries. This article was published quite a long time ago. But at the time when it was published, the article stated that there were 56 nations that had serious problems with landmines. Angola at the time had 20 million mines laying around that were just waiting to maim or kill somebody who got close to them. Afghanistan had 10 million. Cambodia had 4.5. These nations weren't currently at war with anyone. They were at war at some point. And the expense of moving the landmines was just more than the nations could handle, and so they just left them out there. The wars were over, but the dangers of that war hadn't gone away. And a Presbyterian pastor by the name of Andrew Bonner, he once said, "Let us be as watchful after the victory as before the battle." Very sound advice, because that's the reality of the Christian life. We're in a constant warfare, a spiritual warfare, and Satan would like nothing more than to trip us up right after a great spiritual victory, because what does that accomplish if we trip up after a victory? What does that accomplish for Satan? It gives him a victory. But what does it do to us? Absolutely. Absolutely. It makes us start to question. What else does it do? Discourages us. Absolutely. It makes us not want to maybe get back up again. It can ruin our testimony. People can see that victory and then the defeat afterward and look at us and say, "Well, what a hypocrite." So there's several things that will accomplish. And Gideon needed to hear that statement. Let us be watchful after the victory is before the battle. The Midianites had been routed, but Gideon's problems were not over. There were still some landmines, so to speak, that were laying around ready to explode. So far in Gideon's account, we've seen how Gideon responded to the Lord as he called him to different tasks before the battle. Like we said, Gideon originally was full of questions and doubts, but we watched him grow to a point where he just fully relied on God. He was just completely dependent on him for his victories. But now as we start chapter 8, we see how Gideon responds to certain people after the victory over the Midianites. And we see him handle some fairly difficult situations. And each situation is handled a little bit differently. So the first landmine that Gideon had to face was criticism. Criticism. Has anybody faced a critic? Yeah, they're out there. Let's see how Gideon deals with criticism. Let's read verses 1 through 3 as we start chapter 8. It says, "Then the men of Ephraim said to him," so this is after they've more or less got the victory, Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this thing that you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they contended with him vigorously. But he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?" Then the anger toward him subsided when he said that. Do these verses make sense to anybody? The end of verse 3 tells us that the Ephraimites were angry with Gideon. Why would they be angry?
Because they didn't call him to fight.
Okay. One thing that we need to know about the tribe of Ephraim is that they considered themselves to be a very important tribe. Size-wise, they were second to only Judah, so they were a large tribe. And so when you're large in number and you consider yourself to be very important, what is that called? Pride. Ego.
Yeah,
absolutely. The tribe of Ephraim was a very proud tribe. Anybody remember what tribe Gideon was from? Nope. Manasseh. He was from the tribe of Manasseh. So Manasseh and Ephraim, kind of a brotherly tribe there. So maybe there was a little animosity. But what we learn is that because the tribe of Ephraim was so proud, they felt that they should have been included in the original attack on Midian. They were mad that Gideon did not give them a chance to be a part of it. We looked at last week, or 2 weeks ago, several passages later on in the Old Testament where this victory was referred back to. So it was a great victory for Israel. It was huge. And here comes Ephraim as kind of the cleanup crew to clean up the mess. And one of their first reactions is to take offense that they didn't get to be a part of this big victory for Israel. What other reasons might have aided to Ephraim's protest to Gideon? Any ideas why else they would have been mad besides not being a part of the actual war or the battle? They probably missed out on a lot of the spoils of war. Before King David came along, the governing law regarding spoils of war was, if you didn't participate in the war, you didn't get to collect of the spoils afterward. So instead of thanking Gideon for stepping up and being the leader that God had called him to be, stepping up and helping deliver the nation of Israel, they criticize him. Who's ever been in that position before? You've done something great for the Lord's name, and not that we need to receive praise from somebody, but instead of having that, somebody comes up and criticizes the way that, yeah, you've been there. We've all been there. Their comment, "What is this thing that you have done to us?" The tribe of Ephraim, they took it personally. If Gideon had done this intentionally to cause them grief.
Who is Abiezer?
It's Gideon's family, basically. It's the family that he came from.
Oh,
yeah, well, that's he's describing something there. But yeah, Abiezer is kind of the family line that Gideon came from, the Abiezerites, or it's a hard word to say. They take it personal as if Gideon had done this intentionally. But look how Gideon responds. Read his response there one more time. And how would you classify this response?
Humble,
gentle, absolutely both good words. Psalm 15:1 tells us that a soft answer turneth away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. How could Gideon have responded? How could he have answered them?
Get over it,
justifiably, right? Being a conqueror and a national war hero, and as we'll see later on, a kingly candidate, he could have put Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, in their place, and like you said, basically said, get over it. But he doesn't do that. Instead, we see him practicing this principle of turning away wrath with a soft answer. And did Gideon's answer, his soft answer, work?
No.
Yeah, it did. Absolutely, it did. Gideon not only demonstrated leadership and control with his army, but he demonstrated that control with himself as well, controlling his temper and his tongue. Psalm 16:32 says, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty." So he was very much in control. And looking at his soft response to the tribe of Ephraim, is there anything there in that response that would support the fact that Ephraim was a proud tribe? Is there anything in his response? Is there anything in Gideon's response, that soft answer, that would support the fact that Ephraim was a proud tribe? What's that? Yes? How? Where? What is it? Why do you say yes? Absolutely. What is that called? What is he doing to the tribe of Ephraim? Flattery?
Yes.
Yeah. He flatters them. They came to Gideon with criticism, and Gideon responded by telling them what they did, capturing the nobles of Midian, Orem and Zeb, and killing them, was a far greater feat than he or anybody in his family could do. So he swallowed his pride. And instead of reminding them how popular he was and powerful he now was, he just reminded them of how great a task they performed. And how did they take that? Well, hey, yeah, you know what he said? That? Yeah, that's right. We did that. So they took it, and the soft answer turned away wrath. King Solomon in Proverbs 17:14 wrote, "The beginning of strife is like releasing water. Therefore, stop contention before a quarrel starts." And that's exactly what Gideon did with his soft answer to his critics. So his first landmine was the criticism of his fellow countrymen. Any other questions or thoughts there on that first landmine? All right, let's look at the second one. The second landmine that Gideon had to face was skepticism. How about a skeptic? Anybody ever meet a skeptic? Never? Always? Could I have a few volunteers, maybe four volunteers, to read verses 4 through 17, just four verses each maybe? Charlie, take the first four. Thank you, Charlie. I'll read the rest here. And he says, "He went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them. And the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, 'When I return safely, I will tear down this tower.' Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents on the east of Noba and Jogbeha, and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Then Gideon returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth and said, 'Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are weary?" He took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briar, and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. He tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city." What is what's the theory behind cutting the head off the snake?
Can't fight shame.
can't bite you. What else? Cut off the head of the snake, the body dies, right? That's the theory. Well, Gideon and his men were still pursuing these two kings of Midian, knowing that if they had captured and killed them, then the power of the enemy would be severely broken. So as they're pursuing the enemy across the lands, they come to Succoth, and instead of finding encouragement and nourishment from their fellow brothers to continue the Lord's battle, what do they find? Skepticism. They found skeptics. Psalm 133:1 says, "Behold, how good and pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity." Has Gideon found that yet since the victory? No, he hasn't. So Gideon and his 300 men, he still got all 300 of his men, they come across the Jordan and enter into the lands of Gad, Manasseh, and Reuben. Now up to this point, of those three tribes on this side of the Jordan, Gad was the only tribe not to have participated in anything. They ignored the call from Deborah and Barak to go to battle. They ignored the call from Gideon in the very beginning, and now they continue to be of no assistance to the Lord's work. But isn't that about how it goes? The people who are more skeptical are the ones usually unwilling to do anything to contribute. And it makes sense. Skeptics, they generally tend to be the people with a lot of doubt in their mind. And do doubters usually take action? No, they don't. Doubters, they don't. Typically, they think that theirs is the only correct way, and they're afraid to step outside of that comfort zone. So while the other tribes were risking their lives for the deliverance of the nation of Israel, the people of Gad sat back and did nothing. So what were the people, the men of Succoth here, what were they skeptical of? That he was actually going to succeed. They didn't believe that he would do it. Despite this great victory that 300 men had against 135,000 men, despite the fact that the tribe of Ephraim had already captured the two nobles of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, the men of Succoth didn't think that Gideon would continue to be victorious. But even at that, even if they didn't think Gideon would succeed, why would they not offer any assistance to him? They're skeptics, absolutely. They wanted to sit back and not be involved. They didn't see this as an opportunity to feed a hungry brother in need. Instead, they saw this as a risk. Why would it be a risk? There you go. They're thinking that Gideon's going to fail, and if Gideon fails and the Midianites find out that, hey, this group over here aided to them, they could be a target for the Midianites. And that's, you know, the Midianites were always coming and raiding, and that's what they're fearful of. The fear that possessed the men might be understood, but it's the skepticism of the men that Gideon was unwilling to overlook. And as we read verse 15 there, what kind of tone does it sound like they're speaking to Gideon with? It actually describes it a little bit.
Here they are. They ridiculed him about what he had to say.
Yeah. Verse 15, he actually says, concerning whom you taunted me. So they, when Gideon had originally come through there, they were almost mocking him. And they were taunting him. And then when Gideon went to the men of Penuel and asked them for the same, you know, help, he received the same response from them as well. And so how did Gideon respond to these skeptical men? Did he give them a soft answer this time? He warned them. He gave them a stern warning. He warned them that when God did in fact give him the victory, he would come back and he would discipline these men, and that's exactly what happened. Gideon and his men were given the victory over the two kings, and with their army in flight and with victory in hand, he returned the way he came, right back through these cities, and he kept his promise. He goes to the men of Succoth-Firth first, showing them that the two kings, he had indeed captured them, and then apparently he beats them with thorny branches, and then from there, he goes to Penuel, and their punishment, their discipline was a little bit more severe. He tore down one of their towers, and as a result, killed men of the city. So, with the critics of Ephraim, Gideon was slow to anger and used a kind word to avoid any further conflict. Why did he not show the same kindness to these two cities and forgive their offenses as well? Any ideas? Were the offenses similar?
No.
They were both sinful, right? But how were they different? Yeah, on one hand, the issue being dealt with was pride with the Ephraimites. Now, on the other hand, the issue was not only pride, but pride followed up by rebellion. Not only were the people of Succoth and Penuel rebelling against God and his chosen leader, but they were also assisting the enemy in a way by not giving aid to Gideon. So both issues were sinful, but had to be dealt with differently. And just like Gideon, leaders in the church today must have discernment in those kind of situations as they come up to these different decisions. Obviously, we live in a much different time than back then, and we don't go around killing people who rebel against God. But even today, the actions taken against those who are knowingly living in sin and unrepentant of it are much more drastic than actions against somebody who is just has an issue with pride. So even though Gideon had this great victory, both nationally and spiritually, the enemy's attacks just kept coming. The landmines were still there with every step Gideon took. So that's the two different ways so far that he's addressed his landmines. Any thoughts or questions? All right, let's keep on moving. Before we get to the sad end in Gideon's story, Gideon has some unfinished business to deal with. Read quietly to yourselves verses 18 through 21, and then somebody tell me what is going on here. What was Gideon's unfinished business? What's going on here in these verses? Okay, so his unfinished business was a personal vendetta. Zeba and Zalmunna had apparently killed Gideon's brothers, probably in a previous Midianite attack, and Gideon has some unfinished business with them. Does it sound like they try to spare their lives? No. What did they say to Gideon? What was the first thing they said?
They all resembled the son of a king.
What does that sound like there? Does it almost sound like they're trying to flatter Gideon a little bit? Telling him that, hey, you know, he said, who are these men you killed? Well, they were like you. They look like princes, sons of kings. So I almost got the idea that they were trying to spare their lives by flattering him a little bit. It doesn't work. Gideon asks his son Jether to kill the two kings. Why Jether? It was Gideon's personal vendetta. Why would he ask Jether?
His firstborn.
His firstborn, so his oldest son. But why him? Why wouldn't Gideon do this himself and feel vindicated in it? There you go. Back in those days, the way a soldier died was important to his reputation. So to have a youth then kill two kings would not only serve to humiliate the two kings and their descendants, but would also do the opposite for Jether, would bring him great honor. Here's this youth that killed the two kings of Midian, bring honor to his family. He would be known as the one executing the two evil kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. But could Jether do it? No, he couldn't. He hesitated. And when Zeba and Zalmunna saw the boy hesitate, what did they do?
Why don't you just do it yourself?
And was it in a honorable fashion that they asked? It was again another mocking fashion. Gideon was again being taunted. So if you were to paraphrase their statement, it could sound like this. If you are a man, Gideon, you kill us, or you like a child. So they were taunting him. And apparently this was the final straw to be broke in Gideon's patience, and so he kills Zeba and Zalmunna. But again, being taunted, this was the second time now that Gideon, his pride had been attacked. Who has had their pride attacked? Has anybody here had their pride attacked? No? Never. Yeah, I'm not prideful. I can't be attacked. As your pride continues to get attacked, does it become easier to shrug it off, or does it become harder? Harder. It becomes harder. We have this instinct and a desire to protect our pride, and Satan knows that. And so he keeps poking at it. The exact same thing that's happening to Gideon here. All right, let's read verses 22 through 27, where we see the demise of Gideon. Starting in verse 22, it says, "Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son, and your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.' But Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you, but the Lord shall rule over you.'" Sounds good so far, right? "Yet Gideon said to them, 'I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil.' For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. They said, 'We will surely give them.' So they spread out a garment, and then every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. Excuse me. Besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes that were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks. Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household." Does anyone see this passage as kind of puzzling?
Yeah,
good. We see here two requests. The first request is from the people directed to Gideon. Then the second request is from Gideon directed back to the people. What was the people's request? Be our king, Gideon. He was now a national war hero. He had become quite popular. And when he returns from this big victory that included you know, the capturing and the killing of two of their kings, the people ask him to be their king. Would this be standard practice for Israel? Or was this a new thing? It was a new thing. Barak was not asked to be king after his victory, nor was Deborah, or Shamgar, Ehud, or Othniel. So the previous judges, none of them had been asked to be king. Remember chapter 17, verse 6, our theme verse for Judges, reminds us that in those days there was no king of Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. So what purpose would the people have in making this request of Gideon? Why would they want a king now? So effectively, okay. Absolutely. Maybe a little guarantee for the people, bring unity and stabilization to the country. Maybe a little organization against future attacks from the enemy countries. It would be a way of repaying Gideon for what he had done. You stepped up, you took the steps to become the leader. Let's make you king. What did this request reveal about the nation? Absolutely. They despite the fact that God had demonstrated through Gideon that he was still present and still had a very deep personal care for his chosen people, the nation of Israel, they still sought an earthly king. And Gideon did an honorable thing by reminding them that God, the one true God, was their king. Moses had warned that Israel would one day desire to be like the nations around them and ask for a king. And we see here that they do just that. But Gideon's response, it was an admirable run, but here's where it gets a little puzzling. We see the second request. And as it reads, it almost sounds as if in the same breath, Gideon turns down being a king of Israel, reminding them of their one true king, but then he turns around and he asks for all this gold. He turns down being a king by title, but then he turns around and he asks to be treated like a king. He asks for all this gold, and they gladly give it to him because they feel that they owe him for the delivering of the nation. So it's kind of a puzzling little portion there. But as chapter 8 closes, the remaining verses describe Gideon's new lifestyle. He'd become quite wealthy now, partly because of what the soldiers had all brought into him, but partly because of the spoils of war that he had got himself. Yes, Connie?
What's an ephod?
It is, it's like a breastplate that they were using in the...
Or a robe. It's something that you wear.
Something that the priests that would actually wear. So it is an ornament of sorts used for the priests in worship. What's that? I don't know. Maybe. Yes. Yeah. Yep. So he had become really wealthy, and we read that he had many wives and even a concubine. 70 sons from his wives, one from his concubine, which we are told his name. He names him Abimelech. And does anybody know what that what Abimelech means? I know, it's a hard one. It means, my father is a king. So does it really sound like Gideon did not want to be king? Yeah, not on paper at least, but he sure desired the lifestyle of what it meant to be king. At this point, the man of faith that we saw growing in the Lord was now leading the people into idolatry. Gideon, he made an ephod with, and the nation of Israel played a harlot with it. So what happened to Gideon? What happened? Why the sudden change? What happened is that Gideon's pride was attacked one more time, but this time it was a little different. It seems that that Satan wasn't gaining any ground by making Gideon defend his pride, and so he tries a new approach And instead of demeaning Gideon and his pride, what does he do? He boosts it. Gives him a little fluff. The people come to him with this request for a king. They bring all this gold, and Gideon goes quickly from pointing them to their one true king to pointing back to himself. So a little different, but his pride was still attacked. But think of the great opportunity that Gideon had to lead the nation to spiritual revival here. Everybody is now looking at him. He had already gotten rid of the idols in his hometown. He had torn down the altars of Baal and removed the idol worship. But the rest of the nation needed that as well. They needed to turn back to God. He had an opportunity, and he missed it, because now all that he could see was himself. He was no longer looking to the Lord. Maybe we're out of time, but maybe take some time this week and read Deuteronomy 14. Compare the way Abraham acted and led the people to the way that we just looked at Gideon acting. And maybe we'll talk about the difference next week if we have some time. But Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before the stumbling. The ending verses of chapter 8 not only describe the lifestyle that Gideon was now living, but it sets up the downfall of Israel. This coward became a conqueror. He grew in the Lord, had great victories, but then became a compromiser. And because Gideon compromised, he was no longer looking to the Lord. And how does his legacy end? Not on the upward turn. It turns down. It's hard to follow a leader that compromises. It's hard to trust someone that's compromising, and that's what Gideon was doing. But not all bad. Gideon's a great example for us to look at and see of just how someone looks at themselves as not being usable, but when you turn around and let the Lord use it, you can accomplish great things. Well, we've gone over time now, but any other thoughts or questions?
Yes. But in verse 21 and 26, their trust is met being part of the adornment of a camel.
Yeah.
And since the Ishmaelites are predecessors to the current Middle Easterners, who are the enemies of Israel, the fact that their symbol is the crescent. It's just the fact that it goes back.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, that's, I didn't even see that. Good observation. That's great. Any other observations, thoughts, comments? We've got a couple more judges to look at. We'll probably look at the story of Abimelech. He wasn't a judge, but he kind of continues Gideon's story a little bit. There's a few judges that are just briefly mentioned that, hey, they judged for X amount of time, so we won't spend a whole lot of time on them. But a few more weeks looking at the judges, and then we'll be wrapping it up and starting a new series. But
what I got is 27 there. What you made it in the part that you guys said
Yeah, they did. It was idolatry, is what it was. They worshipped it. Yep. All right. Let's go ahead and close in prayer. Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for the example that we have in Gideon. Like I said, it's not all bad. It definitely, Lord, we see that it doesn't matter how we see ourselves. You just need a willing and available body, Father, and you can accomplish great things when we just fully trust in you, and just take one step at a time by faith in you. Just great encouragement for us, Father, and a great reminder that we are never going to be free from attacks until we are with you, Father. And so, Lord, I pray that as the Presbyterian pastor said, Lord, I pray that we would be as watchful before the battle, the same after the victory. Lord, it's so easy to get caught up and see ourselves as being able to handle the situation, quit looking to you, Lord, and that's right when we fall. And Lord, you are so faithful to pick us back up and get us walking again. But Lord, I just pray that you would just keep us watchful and mindful of our pride. Lord, I just pray that we would swallow it and just continue to look to you. Father, thank you again just for this morning, the lessons learned here. I pray for the remainder of our worship service this morning to you through the singing of song, the study of your word further. Lord, I just pray that it would be honoring and just a delight to you, Father. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.